Are we doing this? Really?
Wait for it.
Are we doing this?
Wait for it.
Pow! What the fuck?
WTF.
And it's also, what the fuck?
What's wrong with me? It's time for WTF.
What the fuck?
With Mark Maron.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What the Buckingham Palace guards? There you go, UK. There's one for you. And it seems like that's all I'm going to do today. Welcome to the show. I am Mark Maron. This is my show. This is WTF with Mark Maron that you're listening to now. Welcome. How are you? I hope your jog is going well. I hope your drive is going well. I hope you can live through another day in your cubicle with me saying hello to you. Hello. Well, do the old Marty Allen. Hello there. Hello, people. And well, if you're lifting weights, be careful. You know, don't overdo it. If you're walking with your dog, give him a pat on the head and say that's from Mark. Look, we have a couple of guests. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Jim Gaffigan's going to be here today for a few minutes to talk about, you know, Gaffigan stuff, his book and whatnot. And then Martin Starr, who I talked to for an hour. I enjoy Gaffigan. I want you all to know that when somebody like Jim comes by to talk about his new book, it's not a paid spot. It's because, you know, Jim's got like 900 children. And well, not 900, but at least five. And he's a hilarious guy, and he's an old friend. And he wants to come by and talk a little bit and talk about his new book. I'm like, sure, buddy, anything I can do to help you maintain this incredibly unrealistic life you've gotten yourself into by continuing to produce children. And he loves them very much. I'm just saying, you got to help a guy out. There's people who are broke, then there's people that, you know, they got to, you know, it's like, you know, Papa Jim's never going to be able to stop. But all that aside, I always like talking to Jim. And he'll be by in a few minutes. And then Martin Starr, that was an interesting conversation. Wasn't sure where that was going to go or how that was going to work out. You don't think about Martin Starr and think like, boy, that guy never stops talking. But he was great. Sweet guy. Interesting life. And there was a lot of stuff to learn about him and to, you know, put some other things together about some of the shows that he was involved with, like Freaks and Geeks and Party Down and other things, and where he went and what he's up to now with Silicon Valley. But it was he was an intense guy, and I really liked talking to him. He asked me to do something with him, and I haven't followed up on that. So maybe I should call him. I don't have to do it right now, but perhaps I should do that soon. Hey, you know, it's weird. I talk to people about jury duty. Like I get summoned for jury duty and I freak out. I'm like, I got to be on the road. I got work, my work. It seems to me that maybe I'm mistaken, but it seems to me when the original idea of jury duty was put together, they, you know, anticipated people primarily worked in town. A lot of times my work is not about town. A lot of times there's a lot of, there's a lot of things in the balance. There's scheduling and stuff. And I freak out. It's the last thing I want to do. But there's part of me that really wants to do it. The one time that I called in to serve, it was over, like, it was December, and there was just no trials going on. So I got off then, but I was sort of ready to do it. But this time, you do get a few postponements when you're in the racket I'm in. And maybe everybody does. I don't want to say I'm special. But so I just got the summons and I freak out and I say to my friends, I'm like, what do you guys do with this jury thing? And everybody I talk to is like, nah, I just don't respond to it. I'm like, but you're a bad American. You're a shitty American. You just don't respond to it. You just leave them hanging. So they just shoot these summons out into the wilderness, hoping they'll get somebody. And I think that's true. I think they're like relatively desperate for people to show up. But I do feel it's my responsibility. But not unlike many responsibilities in my life, I'd like to, you know, push it down the road a piece until I got no choice. And then I will do it. So I'll let you know how that goes. I'm still Ebola free, which I'm happy to report. I hope everybody else is doing as well. Again, I know it's been a tough few days for you self-centered people with mild flu-like symptoms, and the people that are in real trouble or real panic. I'm sorry you're going through that, but as far as I know, I'm still Ebola free, going on 51 years. So Jimmy is in town. Jim Gaffigan was here, and he said, why don't we talk for a while? And I'm like, all right. So we talked for like an hour and a half, and I told him it's going to be a while before I get that up. And he said, well, I got a book coming out. And I'm like, all right, well, so why don't we talk specifically about the book and about the incredible weight. Not that he's chubby, but I just mean, like, you know, he's a worker, man. He is definitely a worker. Jim Gaffigan's book, Food, A Love Story, comes out tomorrow, October 21st, and we chatted for a bit. So let's go to me and Jim Gaffigan chatting. Jim, thank you. Like, it's nice of you to come by, but I got to say that it's weird that you're going door to door with the book.
Well, you know, I just think I think this is an important community out here. And,
but it's not even, it's just out today. And, shouldn't you be doing something else? I mean, I understand
I'm also giving WTF stickers.
Well, okay. Well, thank you, for doing
it's
that.
It's like Food, A Love Story and WTF stickers, and also stamps.com.
You had to write this book, though.
Stamps.com.
Thank you. Stamps would be very happy. What is my code? Stamps.com, code
WTF.
Are you using stamps.com?
Ever since I started listening to your podcast.
All right.
You know, there's two episodes that are dropped every week, and it's pretty impressive.
Well, thank you. But now the book, like, I kind of make fun of you sometimes because when people go, I go, Gaffigan's great, he's one of the best comics working, you know, but he talks primarily about food.
Yes.
And it's funny.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, you know, it's
we all eat.
I think we do all eat, and I think there's something about the topic of food where I just stumbled into it, where I mean, look, you start off doing stand-up, and you try on different kind of personas.
Right.
And you eventually just go back to the persona you had, right?
Right.
But there was a moment where I was angry, I was smoking a cigarette, I was more like a tell, and I was, energetic.
You used to smoke, that's right.
Yeah. And so then I came back to this guy who's just kind of this, he romanticizes laziness and what I want.
Yeah.
And what I found with food is I could talk about food, and there wouldn't be any grimace in the audience of like, I don't agree with this premise.
Even if I find out with cats, it's bothering me. But you can talk about animals, and you're not going to have, everyone's going to be like, oh.
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I make a reference to saying that I'm a cat lover, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can feel some of the dog lovers going, all right, I guess we'll let it go.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing with food is, even if somebody is, you know, a longshoreman, or they eat lobster every night, they don't care if I don't like lobster. It's just a vehicle for jokes. And
do you like lobster?
No, I don't. It's just bug meat.
Because
there's not a nickel's worth of difference between that and a scorpion.
No, I get it. And about shrimp? Nothing?
That's a cockroach.
Yeah, I know. You really feel that way.
Peel and eat.
Yeah.
That's a cockroach.
Okay. Yeah, but you don't like the flavor?
I'll eat it because I'm a pig. I like butter. Yeah. I like cocktail sauce. You dip anything in cocktail sauce, you're pretty good. So it's, but you know, the food thing, it's getting to the point where, I want, maybe this will be the end of this chapter.
What are you talking about?
This book is 330 pages. It's like I've covered every topic.
So
what,
you're saying you're retiring the food premise?
I'm going Garth Brooks from food.
Really?
No, of course not.
What the hell would you talk about?
Laziness.
And your kids?
Sleep.
You don't do much about your kids, do
I
you?
I try and keep it to a minimum. Because,
really?
Because
you thought maybe it's not, it'd be hard to find a new angle, or are you just protecting them?
No, I'm protecting the audience. I was that 26-year-old in the audience watching comedians talk about their wife or husband and kids, and I was like, I don't want to hear it. So
need to hear it to learn.
So I'll do like 5 minutes in a special about my wife and kids. But other than that, it's like,
really? But that's odd because, like, it's okay, romanticizing laziness, food.
I mean, I do
lack
hot
of
pockets,
exercise.
You
lack
know,
of
hot
exercise.
Pockets is 6 minutes, and you'd think that, like, when I talk to people, they're like, it's your only joke. You know, some people think that.
That's what landed. What are you going to do? Hot Pockets was the culture's gateway to you.
It was a blessing.
Yeah.
And a curse.
Right. Is that in the book, the Hot Pocket?
That's the name of the chapter, Blessing and Curse.
It is?
Yes.
About the Hot Pockets bit.
Yeah, you know, I was on CNN on Veterans Day. today talking about veterans' rights.
Yeah.
And on the icon below, Doug Stanhope sent me this picture. I think it was Doug. No, it was somebody else.
Yeah.
And my name was listed as Jim, quote, Hot Pockets, unquote, Gaffigan. That's how it was listed when I was talking about veterans' rights. So it's like, there's a blessing and a curse, right?
Right. But do you still get, do people still call it out at the show?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you do it?
Yeah, I do it as an encore at the end. I don't care.
They love it.
Well, you know, I'll see, because, you know, I'll look at my audience, and sometimes there will be, you know, a 10-year-old in the audience, in the front row, and he's just sitting there, and, you know, like I can talk about weddings. He's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
But when I get to Hot Pockets at the end, it's all been worth it for him.
doing it for the kids.
No, well, you know, some of it is, it's just, you know, you have a show with a beginning, a middle, and an end, sure. And there's a little bit of, like, let's clean it up at the end.
But I think that you're selling yourself short on the idea of exploring your personal life, even if it's with kids, because I think that it makes an impact on young people. Because if something is funny, it's funny. Like, right. Even when I was a kid, I'd see older guys talk about their wives, and you'd still get a kick out of it. And, you know, somehow or another, it's going to define some things.
Oh, I agree with you.
Yeah.
But there is something about, you know, you got to manage what you're, you know, you can't just... In my belief, you can't just make it kind of like, and this is what I think is interesting.
Right.
It has to be, you know, a show. There has to be, like, I have some jokes that I love that work in Brooklyn. Right? Like,
yeah.
I have like 10 pages of New York City jokes that maybe work on Long Island.
Right.
But, you know, the Bell House.
Sure.
I love doing them at the Bell House.
But they're not going out to...
They're not going anywhere. They can't even, you know, I can do it maybe in the East Village.
Yeah. Not Ohio, though.
No.
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 But
they're not Subway jokes.
But
either.
This book will speak to everybody because it's about food. And there is a chapter in there about your struggle with the blessing and the curse of the Hot Pockets bit.
Yes.
And your struggle with food in general.
Yeah, I would say, yeah. It's not kind of like, I'm going to change my life. It's like, I like to eat. It's one
it's
of the
a celebration.
Yeah, like I wrote it with my wife, and she was like, "You should have a disclaimer at the end saying that you know that these thoughts are wrong."
Did you put that in?
No,
there?
No, I didn't do that.
You don't feel it's wrong
because look, we're all grown ups here. We know we're not supposed to have a Big Mac every day. I do, but you're not supposed to. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
I mean, look, when
I'm the guy who gave you a coupon for a free pint of Ben and Jerry's.
That's right, and I'm the guy who took it.
Yeah.
And put it in his pocket so he wouldn't lose it.
Yeah, you bet you won't.
So.
All right. Well, good luck with the book, man. I'm glad it's out now.
Thanks so much.
Yep. I enjoy Jim. I enjoy him coming by. I like that. I like seeing him. He's one of those guys that was around. I was around when he started, and, you know, we've known each other. I've seen him through a lot of different weights and a lot of different I've seen him, you know, gradually. I remember Jim with hair. There's, you know, it was nice to see him. Oh, yeah. You know what I did is I watched this new, someone sent me, you know, people send me shit. And let me tell you something. I appreciate everything you send me. If you're sending me records and all that stuff, books, whatever it is, I appreciate it. It's gotten to a point where I don't know exactly how to thank everybody. I'm not always great at, you know, following up on email. Sometimes if I like music, I'll tweet about the music if I like it. I do generally listen to almost all the music that I get, and I do browse through the books, and I do read the letters that you send, and I appreciate it, and it makes me feel good, and I'm glad that you guys enjoy the show, and I'm also glad that you feel like you can get stuff to me, and I'm glad that you think that I'm going to love it, and I'm going to say something about it on the podcast or tweet it. That's the gamble, though, really. You know, you're rolling the dice with that, and I think you know that. And I also want to tell you that sometimes I don't have room for everything, so if the stuff doesn't stick, or I don't say I love it, or I want this around, or I'm not, you know, or I'm done giving it the shake it deserves, it will enter the ecosystem. It will enter the book system. It will enter the used record system. Just know that I'm not running a warehouse here. I might need to open one because I am a bit of a pack rat. But someone sent me this Looking for Johnny, The Legend of Johnny Thunders. It's a documentary about Johnny Thunders, the guitar player for the New York Dolls and the Heartbreakers, who I knew very little about, but always fucking loved his tone. And it is a fucking brutal story, man. It's brutal in the sense that, you know, he was a victim of himself. You know, drug addiction is fucking mind blowing. But there was a sweetness to this guy, man. It's just, holy fuck. There are some days where I am so grateful that I didn't get strung out on dope and that I didn't, you know, continue using drugs and that, you know, that I have a daily reprieve from this shit. But on another level, I'm now becoming this guy, and you know, I'm not proud of this, but I'm traveling with a thermos of coffee now. Like, I have to have a thermos of coffee in my car at all times. Granted, not the worst addiction in the world, but it's a little fucked up because I don't know if I'm getting the buzz I used to. I got the thermos of coffee. I got my nicotine lozenges, which I think I've had it. I think they're fucking up my body. And I've had this conversation with you guys before. You know that I have the desire to kick, but it's the same shit. It ain't heroin, but man, I am definitely in I'll kick tomorrow mode, traveling around with my thermos of coffee, doing speed balls of nicotine lozenges and fucking coffee, crashing out at 3 because I can't keep my head up. I am on a drug cycle with this shit, and I'm not in denial about it. Obviously, it's relatively manageable. It's not ruining my life, but come on, man. A thermos of coffee. I'm leaving for the Comedy Store at 8 at night to do a show with a fucking thermos full of coffee, and I'm still going to sleep at night. It's crazy. I'm not Johnny Thunders, okay? But, you know, I'm a little strung out. And I enjoyed that documentary. I'd like to thank whoever the hell sent it to me. I don't even know if it's out yet, but it's it was good, man. If you like that period of music, that, you know, pre-punk New York thing and how, you know, the impact he had on punk music and just his fucking tone on that Gibson Les Paul Jr., man, just spectacular. Let me give you a monkey report. I couldn't be more thrilled that my cat is doing well. He's not only doing well, he's like back to his like excited self. He's running around. He does this thing in the hallway where he does sort of this bobsled move where he runs down the hallway. And when he turns a corner, he runs up the wall a bit and then down. He's just all full of juice. And I'll tell you what I did, man. I just laid off him. I didn't give him the second run of antibiotics because I thought he was spent. And, you know, when he got sick and he started puking and he was deathly lethargic, you know, I went away for the weekend. I had my friend watch him. We come back. And, you know, I came back and, you know, he was still kind of fucked up and I was nervous, but now I got him on this urinary tract food and I'm very diligent about giving him the, you know, the wet food and about, you know, giving him some love. And the guy is all full of the beans. He's back. He's back. Monkey's back. Thank fucking God. Pow. I just shit my pants. JustCoffee.coop, available at WTFpod.com. If you get the WTF blend, I get a little on the back end. That's a classic. It's a classic plug. All right, look, this interview with Martin Starr was very moving to me, and it was nice to get to know him. So I hope you enjoy it as well. Martin Starr and me talking. Where do you live?
I live here.
In
Westwood.
Oh, you do? In Westwood?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had anyone here in here who's lived in Westwood.
Now you have.
It's a big day.
Yeah.
And that's just where you settled in Westwood? You're like...
Just the beginning of the new barriers we're about to break. Uh-huh. I grew up in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But where in Los Angeles?
I was born at Santa Monica Hospital, St. John's.
So you're always here?
I've always... I lived in Florida for 1 year, which was a terrible year of my life.
That sounds like a good place to start. Oh, what year was that?
I was 15. I had bought a dog in Los Angeles 2 months before we left. That was like a pit bull.
Was that after Freaks and Geeks?
Oh, way before. Well, not way before, but a few years. A year and a half.
Your whole family moved to Florida?
Just my dad and I.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right after the divorce, or how'd that work?
Divorce was when I was 4.
Okay. So your dad, what, decides, like, we're going to Florida?
He was getting remarried.
Uh-huh.
And so my stepmom is living in Florida with her family.
Mm-hmm.
So she had 3 kids.
Uh-huh.
This is where it gets a little complicated. She was also my aunt.
On whose side? Your mother's? Is there...
My mom and my dad
mm-hmm.
Are married.
Yeah.
And my mom's brother is also married.
Okay.
The two people not in that family
uh-huh.
of my mother and her brother
mm-hmm.
get married to okay. each other.
So your father and I get it.
Mm-hmm.
So that must cause some drama.
Yeah.
So
it was bound to.
So let's go back to the dog.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so I just got a dog, and I think the most it was just heartbreaking to have to leave this dog.
But yeah.
I bought it off the street from a homeless man who had clearly just stolen it.
Yeah.
And I didn't piece that moral decision together, but I basically stole a dog for $5.
$5 dog.
$5 stealer.
It's a $5 dog.
So I bought the dog, and then I had to give it up 2 months later before we moved to Florida. And
it's a heartbreak. The heartbreak.
Yeah.
It is kind of sad, though, right?
It was sad. Yeah, I still think about that dog. It was this like beautiful white pit bull with a brown diamond on its forehead.
Uh-huh.
Called a Casper.
Okay.
Really beautiful dog.
And you don't know what happened to the dog?
We gave the dog to a friend, and that guy took good care of it, as far as I know.
You never checked back in?
I didn't really know the guy too well, because we didn't know anyone that could take the dog, so right. it ended up being a friend of a friend.
Right. But you, okay, so you found the dog a nice home, and then you go to Florida with your dad mm-hmm. for the worst year of your life.
It was pretty terrible, yeah.
Well, you're 14. I mean, that's a big, you're cognizant, you're awkward, you're high school, and then you're the new kid. What part of Florida?
I was 15, and Tampa, middle of Florida.
Yeah.
Middle of the shaft.
Familiar,
The hanging flaccid dick of Florida. it's just a terrible place.
So not even a nice beach.
No, they're like these murky, disgusting kind of waters that are warm year-round. So I guess it's nice in the winter when it's 70.
Yeah.
But like in the summer when it's like 110, you don't want to be in warm water.
It's gross. It's like going into a bath.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
So what was, it was just an awkward year, miserable?
Yeah, I think we started off in the summer. One of the most memorable, terrible things that happened was I was lighting off fireworks, and perhaps this is my own karma to get myself into this place, but I was lighting off fireworks, and I just notice that my leg hurts a little bit, and I look down, and ants, red fire ants, had been coming up. I'd somehow stepped directly into an ant pile, and they just were running up my, like, it was literally, like, just red.
Yeah.
All the way up my leg.
Oh, my
and
God.
Up this, like, poncho that I was wearing because it was raining a little bit.
Yeah.
So they were just all over me, and I was stripping, running back to where we lived, stripping off all my clothes and down to my underwear as I ran into the door and then stripped my underwear off and jumped into the shower immediately to take a really cold shower.
Yeah.
And it did not. It still didn't work. It's just so painful.
Florida.
Ugh.
Awful. Couldn't even enjoy the fireworks.
No.
How many did you get off before the ant predicament?
I don't know. I think one or two.
Oh, man. The whole day ruined.
It was pretty terrible.
Were you by yourself?
No, I was with my dad and my brother.
So you just had a bolt? Did they tell you, go, get it?
I just ran. I didn't know what to do, and I think my dad told me to go hop in the shower, so I just ran back.
How many brothers you got, just you and your brother?
I have three stepbrothers.
Okay.
Zero full-blood brothers or sisters.
You were an only child?
Siblings. I'm an only child. For the most part, yeah.
For the most part, other than the stepbrothers?
I mean, I they weren't around too much.
Right. But I mean, for the first 14 years, you were sort of an only child?
Well, my dad had a previous marriage. So he'd been married once, then married
before
my mom.
Before your mom.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had some stepbrothers from there.
I have a stepbrother and two stepsisters.
Wow, so six total.
Mm-hmm. And they're very interesting people, beautiful, lovely people.
Is that sarcasm?
No, I mean that
in all
genuine.
That's nice.
I have an interesting family, yeah.
Yeah. And so what brings you back to Los Angeles? Just sort of like, fuck Florida?
Yeah. I mean, that was a big part of it, yeah. It was get me the fuck out of here.
You didn't go live with mom?
I did, yeah. I came back and lived with mom and her boyfriend at the time, this guy, Frank.
Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Good guy?
Yeah, really good guy. I think he meant well. Really good businessman.
Yeah.
He was very business-minded. And even at that age, because he was around when I had started working on Freaks and Geeks, and he was kind of like pushing me to do more business-minded things with whatever, the product that I was selling. That's kind of how he would look at it.
Right.
And now I understand. But then I was just like, I just like acting, man. Like, I don't know why you got to make this like a thing where I'm like, I'm a product. But he had a good head on his shoulders in that regard. I just don't want to be, I don't know. I never really, business wasn't
your thing?
Yeah, or part of like why I do this.
And when did the acting start?
Well, my mom had a business that kind of revolved around acting.
Which was?
And she moved out here to be an actress. It was called In the Act, and it was a business where casting directors and producers and directors, I think, as well, would come in and share with a class of actors.
Right.
That had, you know, paid $20 to come to this class. It would share with them scenes from something they'd worked on or something they're doing now or something like that.
Right.
And they would kind of like give notes afterward,
uh-huh,
after a cold reading. So they, uh-huh, were like basically cold reading workshops with producers and directors and casting directors.
Did your mother ever succeed in acting at all?
Yeah. She's worked for the last, since she came out here when she was 18 or 19.
Oh, yeah?
Or maybe a little.
Like anything we'd know?
19, 20. Yeah, I mean, she's had parts in a lot of things. I mean, she was in, like, Beastmaster way back when.
Uh-huh.
She's been in a lot of stuff, man.
Yeah?
She was in Silicon Valley, but unfortunately for time, they ended up cutting her out. But hopefully at some point she'll be back. And it was totally independent of me.
Really?
Mike Judge, had just cast her, and they were like, I think we cast your mother. and then I was really excited.
So you guys are pals?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like every relationship is a bit of a work in progress. Ours certainly is.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've recently taken up Clippers games together a lot.
Oh, so yeah.
We're kind of bonding over sports.
And where's your old man?
My dad's in Florida.
So he's just down there.
Mm-hmm.
He's stuck with that one.
Yes.
He leveled off.
He did it.
Yeah. He found one.
He did.
So when do you actually start acting? How old were you?
I think the first time I did anything officially, well, I was young. I was real young. I probably was doing classes and stuff with my mom. She would always like find scenes where if there was one extra person in a workshop,
yeah,
then they would do a scene with me.
Yeah.
And I think those people didn't like it because I would always outshine them. I would always outshine them just because like...
Oh, in her workshops, you mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I was just there... If there was an odd man out, then I would go and do a scene with that person. And some people were kind of excited at it, and other people I think were bitter, and they were like, this fucking kid's going to steal all my thunder.
Just by virtue of being a kid.
Yeah. Just like, you have quality. Like, you just don't care. There's a nonchalance even just being there. So, whether you're good or not.
That's, I think, what everybody aspires to. Like, you got to get back to that.
Yeah, totally.
When you're older. So, were you going out auditions when you were that young?
Yeah. I think I worked on a Bank of America commercial.
Nice.
I'd done a couple other small parts.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And were you like a natural or what?
I don't know. I
But did your mom teach you? I mean, were you ever trained as a kid? Or?
I think when I was, I definitely kind of got training later. But that wasn't until, I think it was like eight, nine, ten, I started taking a class with this guy, Kevin McDermott.
Yeah.
At a place he had started called Center Stage LA.
Yeah.
And that
was... Why that guy?
I don't know how my parents had a connection to him, but once I started going there, I loved it. He was just a genuinely like compassionate person, and the way he would like throw things out in the middle of scenes sometimes,
mm-hmm,
emulates, or perhaps the other one emulates him, but like Judd, I think, directs a lot like that sometimes, and a lot in TV. In comedy and stuff, a lot of comedy directors will just kind of like throw out ideas, and he had he kind of always did that during scenes where he would throw something out if he felt like you needed a boost or you needed some inspiration,
and you'd have to improvise around that.
Yeah, it was an improv class.
Okay.
And I always really liked it because I felt like I was getting the reaction from my peers at that point that made me feel good.
Right, the laughs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the most part. And even, you know, because we did drama improv as well, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's that like?
A lot of crying.
And you could do it?
Yeah, yeah.
But before you started doing acting, were you generally awkward?
I mean, who isn't awkward? I moved around a lot, and I always saw that as, like, an opportunity every time I moved to a new school, because I went to way too many schools. But I always saw that as an opportunity to like change the view of my environment on me.
Yeah.
Like
how would you do that?
Never worked. Well, I always thought like, oh, I'll change. I'll be different. And I'll be the cool guy now wherever I go.
You were going to make that decision.
Yeah, that you don't make that decision. Yeah. I found out after years of trying.
Every school you're like, I'm the cool guy now. Yeah. No.
But I also didn't know how to do it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like those guys who are cool in high school, who usually grow up to be nothing.
I like the emphasis on nothing.
Yeah. Take that, you sons of. But like those guys don't know why they're cool. They just probably are graced with something genetically that they don't even know about, or they just don't care.
Charm and insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're just insecure and you don't have the charm part, mm-hmm. you're in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. But if you're insecure and you're charming, then the world will be your oyster.
Yeah.
How's that? Is yeah. that a good theory?
Yeah.
Well, I just made it up.
I don't disagree with it. I mean, I think those are two qualities that mesh well together.
Charm and insecurity?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Hollywood. Yeah. The entire industry is built on that. So why'd you move around so much? I mean, I know you went to Florida for a year, but you moved around within L.A. too?
Yeah. My parents were very particular about the education that I got.
Uh-huh.
So they would constantly kind of recheck the system and find a new place for me to be.
Even though it meant pulling you out of the social structure and...
Yeah. Well, I mean, they just didn't find the system.
Yeah.
And I went to really, like, you know, quote, prestigious schools.
Like what?
I think the first school I went to for first and second grade was... maybe just second grade. Open school, this place called Open School, which was just like a...
Like a Montessori school?
Yeah.
Like where everyone just sort of like, yeah, it's up to you guys to decide what you want to do.
No, it was it was more like a it was for smart kids, like intentionally for like smart kids.
Were
like
you,
an academics type school.
Were you an academically smart kid?
I could do it. My pistons were firing in that capacity, but I didn't like it. So
right.
I didn't do the homework, but I could pass the tests.
Right.
And so that's what ended up being the marker for me of being able to get into these schools.
Right.
Was like I could do that.
Right.
But then I wouldn't get great grades because I didn't care enough to do the homework, and that's not what drove me.
Yeah.
But I think I've really like peaked when I was in I went to the Los Angeles County High School for the Arts.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, when I moved back from Florida.
So then I guess you were the cool kid there, because everyone's a cool kid there, right?
Yeah, I found it to be an environment that was just free. It was so much more free. I hadn't been in a school environment where people were openly gay.
Yeah.
And that was like, that clearly defined how different this was
right.
from every other
right.
Educational environment I'd been in.
That struck you immediately.
Yeah. And it was like, that's such a great thing that people were free here.
Right.
And open. I mean, there were still like the constructs of the hierarchies
yeah.
and all those things still kind of parlayed their way into the system.
Right.
You know, and the social structure. But it was just a little bit different.
Yeah. And what were the performing arts? The full range?
Yeah.
Like music?
Music,
acting,
theater,
acting.
Dancing, and visual arts.
And did you start doing, you know, actual acting there, like doing plays and that kind of stuff?
When I was just about to do our first year project, would have been my first opportunity ever to do a play, to do actual theater. I left to be a part of Freaks and Geeks.
So you didn't finish the school?
No, it was a really hard decision too. I almost didn't do Freaks and Geeks because I love that school so much, and it took me so long to like. To see this environment, to like be a part of this environment was so rewarding.
So what grade were you in when you stopped?
I was in, I think I only went there for half of my 11th grade year. That was all of my schooling there.
So did you finish high school?
I did. I mean, kind of. I don't know. Seth and I were living together.
Rogan?
Seth Rogan and I were living together when we were both going to like SHOT. I think he was like taking tests here or there. He might not have graduated. I know for a while.
He went to the school with you?
No, but he was still like doing homeschooling
right.
from Canada, from
right.
his school in Vancouver.
Right.
And I don't know if he ever, then he just kind of stopped. I know that he just didn't give a shit and stopped at some point because clearly this wasn't going to be a part of the trajectory of his life at that moment.
And it wasn't.
No. He may have never graduated. I'm not actually sure. But I went to a school where I cheated on tests. Like they honestly didn't care enough to really monitor anything.
But the choice to take the role over, not take it though.
Oh no, that was something that I like pondered on for a while.
What was the audition process on that? I mean, because that show is so important to so many people and so specific. And your character, that character of Bill, was so pivotal. I mean, like, I talked to Judd about it, you know, and many of the people that I know who like that show, you know, that scene of you just watching television,
mm-hmm.
you know, by yourself is like one of the most powerful moments of television for a lot of people that I've talked to.
Mm.
And that was that, just that.
Hmm.
You sitting there, given your environment, given your situation, and watching comedians and laughing, is a, you know, it was, it's just a defining moment. So how was, walk me through the process of how all that happened, because Judd and Paul were so much younger too.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like?
My experience, my memory is meeting with Allison Jones and reading for...
Casting agent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, the one, and just a wonderful human being. Like, really, just a sweetheart. But I went in and saw her, and I read for Sam, and then I think I read for Neil, and then... or maybe I read for Sam, and then she brought me back in for Bill. She was like, go read this and come back. And so then I came back in and auditioned again, and then she was like, that was great. And she, like, you could see, she was like, that was great. And I was like, okay. And then I just left. It just, to me, it was just kind of like another audition at that point.
So you had already been sort of, you accepted auditioning as not necessarily a personal rejection, just part of the process of trying to do what you want to do.
Yeah. I think now it's a lot harder. It's funny how then it didn't matter. I also didn't think I was ever going to be an actor. I never thought that, like, that was something that I could possibly do, because it seemed so far-fetched to succeed in that arena. And I was very aware that, like, it wasn't just talent that it took. It took a lot of drive, and generally success in whatever field takes so much more than a single trait or characteristic. It takes a combination of a lot of things, and drive is the biggest one, I'd say, for most people.
And but you didn't feel like you had that?
No, I just didn't. I didn't think, like, I didn't know, I didn't trust myself, or right. I knew that, like, within my acting class, my improv class, I felt like the man, but and I felt like I could handle myself there, but I didn't know that I could ever succeed in this
right.
business. It's such a huge business,
right?
But I left that audition just thinking it was another audition, and at that point it was. And then I got a call back, and I think Judd and Paul were there eating pizza or something. They'd just gotten lunch, and they were trying to take care of everybody that was waiting in the waiting room, so they weren't, like, sitting and eating, which a lot of people will do, and just, like, make people wait.
Right.
They were, like, very understanding. They were just very courteous. And so I remember going in and auditioning for them, and then leaving, and then getting called back to go to NBC for tests.
So it's interesting that you wanted to commit your life to this, but you didn't have that much confidence in it.
I had confidence in my own ability. I just didn't have confidence that, like, this was the thing. Like, I still wanted to be, like, a veterinarian, or I was still, like, trying to figure out, you know, when you're 16 years old, you're not, at no point was I like, this is it. Like,
yeah.
This is what I have to do.
Right.
Because you're still so unsure and awkward, or at least I was.
Yeah.
I never had this decision. I never
right.
made a decision. I kind of, like, let my environment make that decision. I think after Freaks and Geeks, I was like, oh, okay, so this is it. This is what I get to do.
Right.
So now I just have to put everything into it.
Okay, so you get cast. They tell you you're the guy.
Uh-huh.
When do you meet everybody else?
Well, I met everybody at the tests, I think. Well, I met Sam. I met Sam Levine, and I think I met Sam Levine there, and I met John Daly there, and then three other people who were testing for each of our parts as well.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships started to form pretty quickly.
Yeah, with who?
I think James and I became fast friends. Seth and I kind of became friends because we were the same age, and him and Jason kind of bonded. Those three guys became pretty fast friends. And Sam and I used to hang out a lot. And then John, I'd try to hang out with a lot, but because he was 2 or 3 years younger, it was just a different environment, because he couldn't necessarily come and hang out the
right.
way that, like, Sam and I had the freedom of having cars and doing what we wanted, and he was still kind of under the authoritarian household family regime.
Right.
He had to listen to his father and stuff like that.
So it's interesting. You became friends with James at first?
No, I just, I remember as the series went on, he and I think of the freaks, Seth and I became the closest, and then James and I became pretty close as well. We started like writing, we wrote a short together, and
Are you guys still buddies?
I don't know him very well, I don't feel like, at this point.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, it is a little weird. Yeah, I don't know. It's sometimes like those barriers are those bonds are broken, and you don't know where you.
Well, he seems to have taken sort of a different trajectory than a lot of you guys, I guess. Are you and Seth still friends?
Oh yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So James is the one that kind of went off and did whatever the hell he's going to do.
Well, I think everybody goes off and does what they want to do.
Yeah.
He just was tremendously ambitious and kind of did all these things that, you know, I don't know that I have the desire to do.
Well, so it's interesting to me because, like, I still, even as a guy who sort of works in show business, that, like, my feeling is, like, well, you guys all have to be friends forever. You know, like, it doesn't, like, you know, you get emotionally attached to people who play roles, you know, over a period of time.
Yeah.
And you just make these assumptions. Like, all of them have got to still be friends.
For the most part.
Yeah. So you move in with Seth, like, during Freaks and Geeks?
Just after. We were 17. I think we were both 17.
Yeah.
And then pretty shortly after that, I went off to do my first big movie. And I was like, this is it. I'll do a big movie. I did a TV show. I did a big movie. The movie will come out and it'll be hot shit.
It'll be gravy.
Yeah, I kind of got a big head.
Which movie was it?
A movie you've never seen.
Uh-huh.
It was called Cheats.
Yeah.
It was initially called Cheaters, and then we couldn't name it that because of the Jeff Daniels TV movie of the week.
Uh-huh.
That came out by the same name, I think. So we changed the name. And then, I don't know. It was kind of doomed. That movie was kind of doomed.
What was it about?
It was about four guys who cheat on tests as like a business inside the school. That's what they do. And I was the guy who writes crazy small. So like people would, you know, if you were chewing a piece of gum on that wrapper for the piece of gum would be all of the notes you needed for the test.
Right.
All of the answers would be there. I was the guy who did that. And I also had asthma. It was a very interesting, fun.
So after Haverchuck, you were like the nerd kid.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, it would fit, I suppose. But that was a nerdy-ish character.
Well, when you were doing that, the Haverchuck character, like that scene, like Judd's recollection of it was something from his childhood. Do you remember that scene where you're just sitting there watching television?
Yeah, totally.
What was your experience of it, of doing that?
Judd and one of the other writers was, they were screaming out jokes to me, because that whole scene is, you know, without
sound,
audio.
Yeah. So they were just, you're just sitting there watching, and they knew there was not going to be any sound.
Yeah, and they were just screaming out jokes. I was looking at a blank screen at that point, and they were just shouting out jokes that they remembered from their childhood, and what ended up just becoming the dirtiest jokes that they could think of to try to make me laugh.
Yeah.
And they succeeded.
So that's the beauty of acting. That's what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
But within the story, it was this difficult world you were living in, and we were experiencing you having the one bit of reprieve that you get from the insanity.
Mm-hmm.
And what were you, like, what other things did you do? Because, like, in my mind, you know, when you're a child actor, which you kind of were,
for sure, yeah.
Who were you hanging out with? I mean, you're living with Seth, but what do you do for hobbies? Did you build a life for yourself?
Seth and I smoked a lot of weed.
Yeah.
And that went well for a while. And then...
It seems like Seth still smokes a lot of weed.
Seth has kept it up.
Yeah. He's committed.
Yeah, he's built more momentum, I think.
Yeah.
I think... Snoop Dogg smokes more weed than him, but
just by a hair.
Up there. Well, I asked Snoop Dogg fairly recently how much weed he smokes per day.
Yeah,
and he said a half ounce.
What?
Well, he said it first. He said depends what day, and I said today.
Yeah.
He said a half ounce because I'm working. I said, oh well, how much on a regular day? Ounce and a half.
Wow,
it's out of control.
Yeah,
I think
build up a. I think you build up a tolerance.
Ounce and a half of weed. Oh, for sure you do. I mean,
do you smoke still?
No, I quit a long time ago. I kind of started, I had trouble sleeping recently, and so I started smoking a little bit of weed again.
Did it help?
To go to sleep, yeah. Works wonders.
And but what are the things you do? You're a mystery to me. Like, I was concerned. I'm like, I hope we can talk. You know, because I'm a fan. But I was like, wondering, like, what's his private life like? What's he up to, that guy? What do you do for fun?
Well, I was raised Buddhist, so.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Why would I question that? Are you lying to me? Martin, are you lying to me?
Nope. I'm not lying.
What, you mean like Nam Myoho Buddhist?
Yeah.
So your mom was like got into that in the 60s, early 70s?
Yeah, my mother and father both got into it in 1981. I was born in 82.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, and it stuck. I mean, even though I haven't necessarily consistently practiced, it's a huge part of my life and, like, my fundamental core.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you explain it to me? Will it help me? Because I'm, like, you seem very calm, and you seem okay with yourself. These are things I don't possess. So, if you were to...
you do. I mean...
Like, what does it mean to be brought up as a Buddhist? I've only talked to one other one, and he was, you know, his family is very involved in, like, kind of spreading the message of that particular form of Buddhism at the time that it became popular, because it was a time where it's interesting to me that Los Angeles and Hollywood in particular becomes like this testing grounds for things that would be assumed as cults in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But that thing really took off. I mean, the place I remember from it the most is in the Hal Ashby movie, The Last Detail, where Randy Quaid, you know, stumbles into a Buddhist, you know, to that particular form. So I was like, well, that must have been going on in the 70s, because that's where it sort of took off here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what does one do as a Buddhist? What were the things that you learned?
Well, it's based on the principle that everyone is capable of becoming a Buddha, of achieving Buddhahood in this lifetime.
Uh-huh. How close are you?
I mean, it's a large goal.
Okay.
But
is it one of those pretend goals? Like, it's just to give you hope?
No, I do think it's possible, but it's different from, I think, the way that... that Buddhism is thought of, and, like, you know, you shave your head and you wear a robe and you go to the top of a mountain and you find peace in nature and away from civilization.
Right.
This counters that entirely, in that you challenge yourself with the superficial realities of our society.
Right.
And use those to facilitate your growth and development as a human being.
Okay. So what does Buddhahood mean?
I ultimately, like, a place of peace and enlightenment and respect for yourself and your environment. And the ultimate goal of the organization of the Soka Gakkai, which is initially it was the Soka Kyoku Gakkai, which meant Value Creation and Educational Society, and now it's Soka Gakkai, which is Value Creation Society. The ultimate goal is world peace.
So, okay.
Seems very simple. It seems like, you know, I should be a beauty pageant winner right now talking about world peace, but it's really, like, it's something that we should all be striving for, and I feel like it's a forgotten goal as a human being on this earth.
I think that's probably true. Yeah, because people have gotten very selfish.
Sure.
That, you know, we live in a sort of narcissistic culture.
100%.
Careerists. How do I get what I need?
Yeah.
How do I get to be what I want?
Mm-hmm.
So do you chant?
I do, yeah.
Daily?
I try to, yeah.
And does that help? Is that would you consider that meditation?
Yes, and it does help a lot, yeah.
That's amazing. So, like, in terms of the practice of chanting and the sort of, you know, practical elements of what you get from that, because I'd like to meditate, but I don't. So you've kind of
transcendental. You do TM?
No, I don't do anything. Oh. I'd like to. I'd like to sit quietly. But I think if you have a chant or a mantra or something, you can just do it. But you did it all your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels very natural to me. I see sometimes people who are, you know, new to the organization or to chanting or something, their reaction to it, and I realize, oh, what we're doing is weird by normal standards.
Right.
But it just seems so absolutely natural to me.
And that when like, did you get any flack for that ever?
Not that I remember.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Like when
except in our family, because my mom comes from like a very Catholic family, mm-hmm. and so I think they disliked the fact that she veered away from Catholicism and God, and the funny thing is like both religions practice peace, or like that's their message,
yeah,
and acceptance, you know, specifically right. like you look into the depth of Catholicism and. It's about accepting other people and the differences and forgiving people.
Right.
And it's so funny how difficult that seems to be as when it's actually needed to put into practice.
Yeah, well, you know yeah.
I mean, not to, you know.
Shit on Catholics?
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, that really wasn't my attempt. But I just thought it was funny that, you know, how difficult it was to put into practice when, like, that's one of the fundamental rules of the religion.
Well, I think that I think most religions set out to you know to be pretty sort of proactive in terms of people behaving properly and mm-hmm. living a decent life. But then the politics of the religion and the organization of the religion and you know the powers that you know the people that take power within religions kind of fuck things up.
Yeah.
But also with Catholicism, you get the hell business, which is a little too terrifying for me to even wrap my brain around.
Yeah. Were you raised?
Jewish, conservative-ish Jewish, not real with any real sense of God or how to use God mm-hmm. or, you know, what it really meant. It was always sort of an abstract, never something practical.
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, in terms of what you're dealing with, it, there seems to be some practicality to it. It's like you can get some relief from engaging in this, and there's not necessarily a deity that needs to be placated or... or appeased.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any punishment for transgression. Mm-hmm. How does Buddhism deal with transgression?
Well, I mean, mistakes are a part of life. And I think...
Is there a list of mistakes?
No. I mean, it comes down to like moral, karmic understanding. Mm-hmm. So... You recognize in your environment how you're treated and accepting that as something that you deserve as opposed to something that as opposed to pointing a finger of blame at whatever is causing you this problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you always recognize yourself as the thing that can change in any environment as opposed to trying to change your environment because that's always impossible.
But are you supposed to innately know what's morally improper? I mean, where do those lessons come from? Like, okay.
Yeah, but they come more through human interaction, like us talking about what is, I mean, you know innately what's right and wrong.
But let's say you're strung out on drugs and you're like, wow, this is killing me and I just blew somebody for drug money.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm chanting.
Well, then the next moment, every moment is a new opportunity to find yourself on a new path. So as opposed to looking back and blaming yourself for what has just happened
mm-hmm.
or blaming anyone, there's no recourse for what just happened. You're now given the next moment as an opportunity to change for the better.
Right.
So taking that next moment as opposed to focusing on how you've already made mistakes.
Right. So that's the sort of eternal present.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
But isn't in Buddhism, isn't there sort of a duality concept that, you know, the universe is, you know, is what it is? And like, what is the basic spiritual premise of the Buddhist worldview?
That everything is interconnected
mm-hmm.
and that one human being can change the world 100%. But it isn't it's through changing yourself.
Right.
So the constant struggle is human revolution, is what it's called
mm-hmm.
Inside the organization. The organization, now I really sound like a cult member. But inside my Buddhist practice, we refer to it as human revolution, which is just basically, you know, looking inside yourself and changing yourself for the better and being actual proof of the capabilities of this practice.
Wow. So, do you go someplace?
Yeah. Well, we used to be connected with It's all fundamentally based on Nichiren Daishonin.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that kind of pioneered this idea that everyone can become a bodhisattva, that everyone is a bodhisattva of the earth, and that everyone can attain Buddhahood in this lifetime. And at that point, we were connected with the priesthood.
Yeah.
And the priests believe that in order to attain Buddhahood, that the normal lay people, lay practitioners, couldn't achieve Buddhahood unless, I don't think they could achieve it at all, but the priests could help them by being the being the middleman,
right,
between them and God.
Yeah.
And is there
a God?
No, it's the mystic law of cause and effect,
uh-huh,
karma, but the interconnectedness of all living, right, things.
That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that the type of Buddhism you practiced was sort of one of these. It took it from a philosophical, almost insulated, and very specific idea to something that everybody could engage in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the idea. That was the transition into the type of Buddhism that you're practicing. The difference between getting in touch with the big nothing. Mm-hmm. And just, sitting in an enlightened state.
Mm-hmm.
This was we've got to be able to take these ideas and make them practical and, mm-hmm, and applicable to everyday people.
Yeah.
And that's where that comes in.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to be working. I feel more relaxed just talking to you.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome to come to a meeting anytime you like.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that, is there an idea that you should reach out to other people?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was pushed away because I stopped practicing for quite some time.
Yeah.
I think I've kind of been pulled back towards it. Part of that being my father's having kind of health issues. And so I've been spending a lot more time with him, and I've been chanting for his health. And
recently?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is within the last 6 months or a year. And so...
So you were sort of not as active, and now you're more active again?
Yeah.
So it's a way. Were there other points in your life where there was crisis or frustration and spiritual or existential dilemma that kind of pulled you back in?
Short term, yes.
Yeah.
This feels like a new ground. Like I have a better foothold on it now, uh-huh, with this.
And is your father still practicing?
Yeah, 100%.
Oh yeah, is he doing all right or?
He's doing okay. It's a battle, man.
Yeah,
it's a pretty severe battle. So, we're in the midst of it, but
uh-huh,
but he's got a great deal of hope and determination. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's talk about from your relationship with Judd, because for me, I don't watch a lot of television.
Mm-hmm.
Like I saw Party Down, and mm-hmm, I was happy to see you.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like you sort of were in this world of comedy that has become the dominant force in comedy. The people that you were involved with from Freaks and Geeks, with Seth and everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But but the movie thing, when I saw you in Knocked Up, I was like, holy shit! Oh, there he is. like where's he been? But you've been working the whole time.
No, I'd had a pretty big gap, I think, in between Freaks and Geeks and then Knocked Up.
Yeah.
Party Down came after Knocked Up.
Yeah.
Where I got a tattoo and decided I wasn't going to be an actor anymore. And it was mostly due to not feeling respected and encouraged by my environment. I think the people that I can't blame it on them because it was my decisions that put me in that position, but my agents and shit at the time were terrible and didn't really care about me or know how to influence me. In fact,
there was a problem. So coming out of this was after Freaks and Geeks, after a couple of movies,
uh-huh,
where you were sort of being typecast as this dorky kid.
Yeah.
And you hit a wall.
I definitely hit a wall.
What'd you get? What kind of tattoo?
I got this thing.
The star, a bleeding star.
Yeah.
What's the meaning?
Yeah.
At the time, anyways.
At the time, I think it's evolved quite a bit, but at the time...
Good, I'm glad it's still evolving.
Yeah, it's still evolving. At the time, it really just represented my what I didn't like about the business and what I didn't want to be consumed by.
Which was?
the selfish nature, the business side of things.
Right.
It wasn't about what I loved about acting or creation or storytelling.
Uh-huh.
It was all money driven, and you really had to prove yourself to be an asset to these people.
And they have very specific expectations out of you.
Yeah, which were all financial. Like, you really had to meet these expectations that didn't fit into my parameters
right.
of desire.
And, well, they probably and were kind drive. Of cornering you to be some sort of clown.
Yeah, well, they just stopped working for me, to be honest.
Yeah.
The only time I got phone calls, I've felt like that more often than not in my life, that like, that is, for some reason, my place, that like, I'm not, that like, I feel like agents oftentimes when they are representing
yeah.
me, they're just fielding calls a lot of the time.
Right.
As opposed to like fighting for me to be in, you know, movies that they're packaging or giving me opportunities that I don't necessarily have on my own.
I don't know if that exists anymore, that type of agent.
Yeah, maybe you're right. I mean, I know that they are packaging things, but...
Sure, but there's this romantic idea that, like, you know, like, he's out there working for me. Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
They really... there are oftentimes, I wonder why 10% of my money goes to someone that... And to be honest, at the moment, I really like the people that I'm with.
Yeah.
I like them as human beings, and I like talking to them, and mm-hmm. I feel like they have a lot of wisdom when I talk about the projects that, you know, are on the table or something. But it's still, like... I don't really know where I stand or how much I'm gaining in a given moment.
Right.
Or a day or
so what
week
was that,
or month.
When you got the tattoo and turned your back on it, like, well, how did that manifest itself? What was your plan?
Well, I got a job for one day as a barista. I got mm-hmm. paid $2 to get a test, to go be a test barista for a day. And then that was the only job I think I've had aside from acting. And then Knocked Up came up.
So it wasn't that long a period.
No. And I'd kind of decided I wanted to get back into it. And
but how
and,
long was it before, like, you know, when you said, fuck this? I mean, was it years? Or was it...
I think I had quit for a year.
So you had money saved from Freaks and Geeks and stuff?
No, I went broke.
You did?
Yeah.
Now, was there any part of your Buddhist nature that thought, like, this is an opportunity?
No, I think I was in, like, I was in the state of hell. I was not happy at all. I was miserable for the most part. I was terribly depressed. Even through Knocked Up, through shooting that movie, I was in a pretty bad way.
So how did that manifest itself? Were you living alone?
I think I was living with my mom at the time. I was 22 or 23. And,
yeah.
And whatever the case is, I'm sure that's not terribly old to be living with your parents, but I had moved out at 17, so to like go back and live with my mom again was just a rancid idea. Like, just such a terrible.
Like, you failed.
Yeah, it felt so demeaning and demoralizing. Yeah.
And was she supportive?
She was incredibly supportive. She moved
and concerned, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, very, very concerned. But she gave up a lot to help me. Including selling her, she had a beautiful place on the beach, which is where she was going to retire, and she sold that, and kind of ended up getting fucked over, I remember, but then she sold that so that she could get a much bigger place a little bit further east that we could live in together and have more space.
Yeah, so she was worried. Now, were you on medicine, or did you, like, what were you doing? You were mm-hmm. just, like, in dark place?
Yeah.
And you'd given up on the spirituality element of your life, or what?
I was still kind of chanting here and there, but that wasn't, I wasn't driven to do it.
It's weird, because it's not an unusual age to go through that,
no.
But the fact that you'd had this success,
mm-hmm.
and that you'd had your dream sort of shattered for fairly ideological reasons. I mean, it sounds like you probably could have kept working,
mm-hmm.
right?
I don't know.
Oh, they just hung you out to dry.
That's what it felt like, yeah. I remember calling my agent, my buddy David Krumholz, at the time. I like talked to him on the phone. I was like, I don't feel like they're doing anything for me. I was in my car, and I was, you know, just going off to him about it. And he was like giving me all this advice. And he was like, this is what you have to do. You have to give them an ultimatum. You have to call them and you have to say, fuck this. You're fired. Either you're going to start fucking working for me or you're fired. And so after that phone call, it got me all fired up, and I called. And I said basically that like, either you start working for me or I don't think we should be working together anymore. I should be with someone that is going to work for me. And she was like, okay, I totally understand.
So
and I was like, well, like,
what?
What the fuck? Yeah. And I realized through that phone call that, like, this is how she'd felt for 2 years. But because jobs had continued to come in,
right,
she was just taking free money. As opposed to telling me, like, hey, I don't give a shit and I'm not working for you at all. She just kind of left me there gathering money for her based on the work that I had
already done.
Yeah, gotten on my own because of my body of work at that time. And
that's a brutal realization.
It was really hard to take that in and realize that, like, this was just a terrible human being. But that's in some way the nature of
the business,
being an agent.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
Fundamentally, you're just looking to make your company. This is your job, to make your company as much money as you can. And so if you drop someone that's even bringing in a small amount of money, of course, you don't waste any time working for them. But someone who's bringing in a small amount of money, it's not beneficial for you to drop them yet.
Right. No, they're like, who knows what could happen?
Yeah.
That guy could get a call and then I could, you know, get a big payday.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's because, like, there's also this idea. There's a romantic idea of who they are and that they're working for you and that they represent you and that, yeah, you know, you have your shoe in the door and all that shit. And, you know, there's something about show business, about the agent. But, you know, well, I don't know if it was the same experience, but you think, like, well, these are my friends. And, you know, my best interest is, you know, they have my best interest in mind. But then there comes that day where you're like, they don't give a fuck. We're just these movable pieces. And if they can't move the piece, they don't mind just sitting with it.
Yeah.
Until it's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
So you just felt stranded. Mm-hmm. So now you're without an agent and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And your mom, who has been through this, I imagine, before.
Yeah.
Must add some guidance on it.
I don't think I consulted her about what was going on in my life at that point.
Uh-huh. So you're in the darkness for a year, mm-hmm, getting bleeding star tattoos.
Yeah. Well, Jay...
Were you suicidal?
No.
You were just pissed.
I mean, I'd be lying if I said I've never had, like, a suicidal thought.
Yeah.
But there's a huge difference between having that thought and,
yeah,
bringing it into, sure, actuality.
Yeah, one is self-pity and the other, yeah, one is, you know, you mean business.
Yeah.
yeah.
So
then out of nowhere, Judd calls?
Well, I think these things start so much earlier than you're aware of,
right,
as an actor. And so I think it had been in the works for a while. And perhaps it was one of the driving forces behind, you know, some of the people in my life that kind of came to be, like, my manager now. I know that this thing was happening before he and I were together, but he's done a great job for me in a lot of ways, so
yeah,
I wouldn't hold it against him. But this thing was happening and he reached out to me, and then, you know, a month later I found out about Knocked Up, you know, kind of happening, I think. And my agent at the time, who was like this small kind of boutique agent,
yeah,
who wanted to be like a painter and you know, like, really kind, yeah, of live this cliche, like this LA cliche,
yeah.
I remember firing him because we had a conversation about the business side of it. And I was like, well, I want to be more business savvy.
Yeah.
If I'm going to continue doing this, I just want a better head on my shoulders so that I don't, feel unaware and, you know, blindsided.
Yeah.
At any point. So I just wanted to ask as many questions. And the first question was, do you think we should get a lawyer? And, you know, just to, like, deal with the fine tuning of,
yeah,
the contract and stuff like that. And my agent at the time, who just, like, didn't care or have a business mind, he was just like, meh, I think this is all we're going to get. And then I talked to my manager, and he was like, I don't think it'll hurt. And I know a guy who's good who can do it, who will do it pro bono the first time around.
Right.
Just to prove his worth, you know?
Right.
So we did that, and it ended up being so crucial to my financial stability for years to come, really.
For the Knocked Up contract.
Yeah, which, like, wasn't it was just like having a precedent of getting something after the movie's released, getting some, like, getting, like, allotments of money that were predetermined.
Yeah.
If the movie reached certain goals.
Right.
Which wasn't a tremendous amount of money, really,
right,
really, especially considering that it had to reach $100 million first.
Right.
But, like, you know, these small amounts of money meant the world to me at that,
yeah,
point, because I was completely broke.
Right.
So the fact that, like, he was just nonchalant, didn't give a shit, I ended up firing him for it.
And it worked out okay, because it probably did make $100 million, didn't it?
Yeah, I did.
So after Knocked Up, you do Party Down.
Yeah.
And that was fun, right?
Oh, that was amazing. I was ready to enjoy.
Yeah.
Again.
Oh, and it turned everything around.
Yeah.
Because Knocked Up, like, if you think about it, like, you tell me you're in this dark place, and that character sort of lent itself to, yeah. to a certain amount of...
Well, I think it has to. I mean, my life had to bleed into that.
Yeah.
Or else I wasn't being honest. Because right. it was so defining of my life at that point. Like, it was in every part of the way I was living.
Yeah. What, there's the darkness and the defeat yeah. and the anger?
Yeah.
Well, that character was... it's an odd character. And it was a little bit disturbing.
Yeah. Mission accomplished.
But do you, when you, because you're known for doing comedies, but they are sort of, there's a lot of heart in them, but do you consider yourself a comic actor?
I feel like I'm told it so much that I just have associated it with what I do, but I don't think that's a defining characteristic in what I bring to what I do.
Yeah.
I don't think it has to be comedic.
So the Party Down, that didn't survive, that must have been pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean...
It's the way it goes.
I'm just fucking used to it now. I mean, to be honest, it's more surprising to me that like right now I'm a part of something that is living up to its potential. That like in all ways...
Silicon really, Valley is a great show.
Yeah, it's such an amazing experience to be supported by a network, by an HBO is... gone above and beyond what they need to do and they love the show so
I'm a tough audience, but I really like it, and I'm in like, you know, TJ Miller used to bother me, but like yeah. I gotta give it to you guys. I mean, you really they're and Kumail, who I know well yeah. as a comic, and you know, TJ I don't know that well, but you know, he always annoyed me. And Josh Brenner's on my show. Mm. He plays my assistant on Marin, and he kind of pulled out for three episodes to do my show while he was shooting Silicon Valley. So like I feel like I have something personal, like not at stake, but like I would be more judgmental because I know everybody. Mm-hmm. But like it works so fucking well. It's so funny, and it's so like the ensemble works, and the characters are so well defined, and they seem to really be, you know, great comic characters.
Yeah. We got really lucky too at how open Mike was in the evolution of it, because I think when I first read the script, I wasn't super excited about it.
Why?
Because there was something missing. I think also I'd talked to my friend before I'd read it, and he said the same thing. So I already had that in my mind that like maybe this wasn't the best script. But I remember reading it, and there are pieces there that are beautiful. But there was something in the pilot that, I mean, it's all changed from,
yeah.
from when I read that first
right.
pilot. But aside from what was there, what was most crucial is what wasn't there, which like Kumail and I weren't really a part of it.
Right.
It was more about the two kind of main guys, the guy that runs the house and Thomas's character.
TJ so, like, and...
TJ and Thomas.
Which one's Thomas?
Thomas Middleditch.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. So, the main guy.
Main
yeah.
guy. So it was really kind of about them more, and the side characters in the house were just that.
Right.
And then these girls that come up to Silicon Valley, and this B storyline, which was these girls who come up to meet rich dudes and fuck them and take their money, essentially, or like become
But they're not
rich
even in
them.
It anymore.
They unfortunately just kind of, I mean, even in reading that first pilot, I remember feeling like this isn't, like you kind of have to pick.
Right.
One path.
Right.
You're either following these girls or you're following these guys.
Right.
Because they don't even really meet up in that first pilot.
Yeah.
They like barely interact a little
right.
bit. And it's just such a different tone. And I think the pilot itself found itself. God, I hope no one is like feels disrespected when they listen to this. This is just how I feel about it. They like the way that it evolved, like really embodies the protagonist. Like you have someone to root for,
uh-huh.
and you have this group of guys that came together by way of Mike and Dave Krinsky and Alt Schuler, like getting on board with the evolution of it.
Uh-huh.
And so like I wasn't a part of the initial pilot, the script, and neither was Kumail really.
Mm-hmm.
And so these characters kind of evolved, and they're like, we need this group. And
right.
So the group mentality kind of became a thing, and and that's what it is about. Is
yeah.
Like this group of really weird guys going on this journey together.
Yeah. Well, the satanic element
yeah.
and the Crowley stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it seems to be like, it's kind of something that, you know, it seems very suited to you in the way that he's sort of like strangely emotionally disconnected, but very justified in his philosophy. Mm-hmm. Like that he's countering what's probably emotional or insecurity on some level with this dark philosophy.
Yeah.
Which, well, how did you feel about that? What did you resonate with that? Did you have to do research for that? Did you just stick with the script or what'd you do?
I read the Satanic Bible.
Anton LaVey's right.
Satanic Bible.
Yeah.
I haven't finished it yet. It's quite a read, but it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of informed a lot of
just be have a shameless good time.
What I brought to it, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's funny also coming from this place of almost peacefulness. Like he's like just at such like he has such confidence in himself.
Yeah.
And seems to be the only one that does.
Yeah.
And I think it comes from this place of knowing how this is how the world works. If everybody read the fucking Satanic Bible,
right.
You'd also know that like giving a shit about anything is pointless.
That's also sort of on some level in some you know kind of malignant way that Buddhism speaks to some of that.
Yeah.
Not morally.
Right.
But existentially it does. Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. Were you able to make that connection?
I suppose now for sure, but at the time I think it was purely rooted in this satanic.
And are you having a good time?
Oh my God. It's I've been really fortunate to be a part of Freaks and Geeks, which just an incredible experience top to bottom, soup to nuts. And then Party Down as well, just mm-hmm. a great group of people. And the purpose behind both of those shows was very pure.
Mm-hmm.
And this as well, like to be around, I mean, we're like a family. And to be a part of something where you know that whether this goes or not, whether we are forced to be around each other or not, by way of HBO picking us up for season after season, I'll be friends with these people. These are, you know,
yeah.
These are lifelong friends that I've made already.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
And how many did you do?
We did 8 the first season. And I believe we're doing either 8 or 10 the second season.
Yeah, so that just got picked up and you guys are going. Mm-hmm. When do you start shooting?
We start shooting in October.
Well, Martin, it was great talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. The time just flew right by.
Good. It was fun, too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was great. I loved getting to know that guy. And we talked a bit about me going to one of them Buddhist meetings. And I don't, what have I got to lose by doing that? Maybe that would be it. I mean, it seems like, you know, he got a lot of clarity from it. I'm always nervous, though. I'm always nervous about going to meetings, but maybe I will. I don't even, I mean, it'd be nice to hang out with him on that level, on a spiritual level. Oh my God. I'm so jacked. I need a nap. I went hiking today. This seems to be becoming a tradition, doesn't it? I don't know what I'm going to do. I think that we should all celebrate. I don't want to do that rhythm. I feel like I get stuck in like 3 chords. Maybe. That's like a little talking blues business, isn't it? wish I could sing some, like, you know, I gotta write, maybe I'll write a talking blues about monkey's bladder. I didn't prepare. I'm not prepared. So I really can't do a talking blues because I didn't write anything. And that's no way to do a talking blues. So let's just... let's just pretend that I've written a talking blues. And that right now I'm saying, like, a very important thing that kind of strings itself out, like Bob used to do, and you just keep talking and keep talking, and you don't know when you're going to go back to the G, and you're kind of waiting an abnormally long time for him to get back to the main verses of his talking blues, and then all of a sudden you're in it.
Boomer lives!